You're listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Hi, everybody, and welcome to We Are STS. I'm your host, Professor Joe Kane. I bet you missed us. Well, we're back, and this is episode 16. I'm pretty sure you've heard of Plato. He's one of those philosophers from ancient Greece. Think in the time range 400 to 350 BCE, and you're in the right range. Plato wrote core texts in the Western canon, the Republic, the Timaeus, and so much more. One of his lesser-known texts is the Gorgias. That's this year's STS 1 book. At its heart is a key question for communicators. Should we prefer people who are truth-tellers in society, or should we prefer sweet-talking rhetoricians? This is a question that cuts right to the heart of so much in politics and the way we talk with each other every single day. If you're a regular listener to the podcast, you'll know about the STS 1 book program. Each year, we choose one book for all students and staff to read and to talk about together. Last year, we had Gemma Milne's book Smoke and Mirrors about hype in the tech and innovation industries. And this year, it's Plato's Gorgias. Luckily, here in STS, we have an expert on Plato and his philosophy, Professor Andy Gregory. Earlier in the term, I put in a call to Andy to ask him some questions about this book. I wanted to know what I should be looking out for and what he thought was important. I have to admit, I was a bit skeptical when I first heard about this choice. But now, wow! It's like reading a play about some of the political characters we all know and watch today. As usual, I start by asking Andy to introduce himself.
Hi, I'm Professor Andrew Gregory. I'm from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. My research work specialises in science in the ancient world, and one of the sub-disciplines I look at is the work of Plato.
Now, Andy, the Gorgias was written by Plato. Can you tell us a bit who Plato was?
Okay, so I think by any reasonable person's account, Plato is one of the great philosophers in the Western philosophical tradition. He lived from around the mid-420s to the mid-340s BC. We're not absolutely sure when he was born and died, but that's roughly the dates for him. Critical things, he was a pupil of Socrates, who's another critical philosopher in the Western tradition, and he's the teacher of Aristotle. He lived in Athens. He engaged in philosophy with folk in Athens. He established a research school for philosophy known as the Academy. The important things that Plato were interested in were what is the good? He was interested in not just what is good, but is there such a thing as the good, which is above and beyond everything else? He was interested in issues of knowledge. What actually constitutes knowledge? What is opinion and what is knowledge? And within that, he'll have some interesting things to say about the nature of technology and the nature of science as well. But he's also very interested in how we do philosophy. So we're here very much at the start of an investigation of the world and the investigation of philosophy. And Plato asks a lot of questions about how is it best that we go about discussing the world? What sort of conclusions can we reach and how should we go about doing that? In terms of influence, I'm simply going to quote the English philosopher Whitehead, who says that all modern philosophy is merely footnotes to Plato.
So let's focus on the Gorgias for a bit. So do we know when and where that particular book was written?
Certainly it would have been written in Athens, because Plato lived virtually his whole life in Athens, apart from a couple of journeys outside. We think it was written about 380 BC. We can date that by partly by the nature of the Greek, partly by relation to Plato's other works. But 380 BC seems a pretty good date for that. When we say writing, this would be literally writing. So Plato, in terms of actually writing it, he would probably write it on wax. So the Greeks would have a 1 foot square piece of wax, which they would write on, and then someone would then transcribe that onto parchment or onto paper. So that would actually be quite a laborious process. So it's actually literally written in about 380 BC, and that's quite an intensive process. And books would have been very valuable in that culture because it took so long to produce them.
I have the idea of a book like we understand books today, either on a as a bound set of paper or as a even a roll of some kind, a scroll of some kind. Is that what we're talking about, or is that?
I think for a book in that period of Athens, it would be a set of rolls. Right, so you'd have something you unroll, and it would probably be half a dozen pieces of parchment or paper, whatever they wrote on. Put together, and as I say, that would be quite valuable. And you know, the libraries of, say, Alexandria, or built up by the academy, were very valuable things indeed.
Right, and so where does the Gorgias sit in Plato's sort of bibliography and his sort of corpus of work as a whole? Is it an early work, a middle work, a later work? Do we have any idea?
Okay, so Plato wrote about 40 books. We have a fairly good conjecture as to a sequence of those books. So Plato's earliest phase is also known as his Socratic phase, because the main character in his works of the early phase is Socrates. So it tends to be Socrates in dialogue with other people. And the Gorgias is very much that sort of book. There's a question here as to whether these early Socratic works are actually recordings of real conversations that Socrates had, or whether they're complete fictions that Plato made up. And I think the consensus nowadays is that it's somewhere in the middle, right? Socrates had a conversation like this, which Plato has cleaned up, tidied up, and made philosophically more cogent and written into a book. Okay, so this comes from the early Socratic works. Later on, Plato uses other people as characters in his dialogues, and they become, how can one put it, more heavily metaphysical and more heavily theoretical. So they're not such knockabout dialogues with lots of drama in them. They become a little bit more textbook-like, but they still consist of conversations. So the Gorgias is probably from his later early Socratic period, just before he started writing more heavily.
Oh, I see. So scholars really do divide Plato's work in sort of early, middle, late, and if this is coming sort of late in the early period, if that makes sense. And I get that sense of sort of Plato following Socrates around, writing stuff down. That's silly, isn't it, as a concept? Yeah. Okay. But he's certainly part of the, I guess, set of pupils or mentees of Socrates, and so he's soaking it in, and then later sort of trying to remember it, and then, as you say, probably cleaning it up to make it. I mean, it's pretty good if it's just a transcript. That's pretty sharp.
If it's a transcript, it's quite remarkable, because some of these works are actually quite long. They're not sort of things you could commit to memory, even given that the ancient Greeks probably had better trained memories than we do, because they didn't have books to refer to. I think that would be something quite remarkable. There are further sort of issues here as to whether Plato actually agrees with what Socrates says, or whether you can actually read what Socrates, what he's written for the character Socrates, as a position, either for Socrates or Plato. It tends to be a little bit more playful about that, and I'll say something more about that in a moment.
Great, and also that's one of those kind of conversations I think students will have with you and all the other staff over the course of the year, as we talk about the one book in lots of different settings, sort of digging into the detail here. But let's turn to the Gorgias as a book itself. And as you said, it's a dialogue. It features a couple of characters. Who would you say are the main characters in this book?
Okay, so the main characters are Socrates, Gorgias, Polus, and Callicles. Before I say something about those characters, I'm going to say something about the fact that this is a dialogue. So Plato, in all his works, but certainly very strongly in the early Socratic works, his philosophical works aren't textbooks. They are discussions between characters in that book. that's important because it marks a different way of doing philosophy, if you like, a way of doing philosophy that's become redundant since about the turn of the 18th century. There are relatively modern works which are important dialogues. I mean, Galileo wrote the Dialogue Concerning the Two Great World Systems, which is a very important work in the history of science, and that's very much modelled on ancient ways of doing things. Why dialogue? I think one of the things that Plato wants to do when he asks this question about how do we do philosophy is, I think he doesn't want to present you with a text. I think he wants to present you with a drama of differing opinions. And beneath all that really is the question of, what do you think? What's your reaction to this? What's your interaction with these characters? What's your interaction with these opinions? And I think that's very much Plato's way of doing philosophy. It's not something to be taught in a highly didactic manner. It's something to be engaged with. And what's more important is not so much what I tell you about this, but how you react to it. Now, sometimes that makes it quite a little difficult to determine historically exactly what Plato thought, because you never know when he's being sort of provocative or trying to push something or try to push a refutation or whatever. I think his works are much more about provoking you into thinking more deeply about something. And to a certain extent, that's still the quest of philosophy today, to provoke you into thinking more deeply. And I think that's very much what the Gorgias is about.
I mean, that's a fantastic point to say it's a dialogue. And because I've heard people describe Gorgias as a debate, and that distinction seems incredibly important. And you said the kind of Socratic dialogue is a form of exploring philosophy where you ask questions of me, I ask questions of you, and we work towards getting a middle ground. And it's the truth is in that middle ground. And that strikes me, that's really, really different, isn't it, of debate, where you're listening to what I say and you're trying to maybe skewer me and find a mistake so that you can say, hey, I won. I mean, do I have that right? Debate versus dialogue, is that right?
I think that's fair enough, yeah. And I think Plato is very keen on this notion of dialogue for another reason as well, which is characterization. So the characters in his dialogue are often related to the arguments that he puts forward. So for instance, Gorgias himself as a character, he's putting forward this view that rhetoric is of the most greatest importance. And Socrates' reply to that is, no, it isn't. It's really not that important at all. And all you're doing is trying to flatter people and please them. And Gorgias comes across as a bit of a fool who's always interested in flattering and pleasing people. And I think you're meant to see the relation between Gorgias' character and the philosophical position he puts forward. And that's quite typical of Plato's dialogues. And of course, it's a different way to writing philosophy than sort of picking up a modern philosophical textbook, which will sort of bluntly put down, this is how it is, or this is what I argue for, without that sort of characterization. And that's what makes Plato's dialogues that much more dramatic, that not only is there an interplay of argument, there's an interplay of character which is relevant to the argument as well.
So dialogue is a form of proceeding in philosophy to try to understand things better and to get to that sort of essential truth. Plato learns it from Socrates, and the Gorgias is an example of one of those Platonic dialogues. And so when we have students looking at it, they should be thinking, how does this method work? How is the back and forth working here? Okay, that's brilliant. So, and then you mentioned something about the character of the characters, of the people in the book itself. So let's talk about them a bit. So we've got Socrates, we've got Gorgias, we've got two other characters which we haven't talked about yet. Gorgias, it comes off as having a certain kind of personality, and we'll let readers pick that up a little bit. And you say the personality is connected to the style of argument he has. Was Gorgias that a real person, or is this a fictional character?
Gorgias, we believe, is a real person. He is thought to have been born in Sicily and practiced sort of his rhetoric there and brought this rhetoric to Athens. In important theme in Plato. He is very much opposed to a school of philosophy known as Sophism. Now, the ancient Sophists were people who would argue for money, right? So they would be happy to argue any position. It didn't matter whether it was right or wrong or whether they agreed with it or not. They would be happy to argue with that position if you gave them some money. And Gorgias is quite open about they can make the better position defeat the worse position if you are good at sophism and if you are good at rhetoric. Right? This was something that Plato detested because, as I said, how we do philosophy is fundamental for Plato. And he thought, no, this is not the way to do philosophy. Philosophy surely is about coming to the truth of matters, understanding the good and understanding knowledge. And having the weaker argument defeat the stronger argument, that can't be right. So there's a political thing here, I think, about attacking Gorgias, and a thing about philosophical method here as well. And I think we're meant to see that the way that Gorgias, not only Gorgias's position is wrong, but his way of doing philosophy is wrong, because his position implies that you just say things to please, whereas Plato's position is we are moving towards the truth. And if you compare that with the character of Socrates, Socrates is always going on about the truth and what's right and what's moral and what's good. Sometimes Socrates will claim, I know nothing, in order to elicit a definition or some sort of statement from somebody else that he can then discuss or attack or deconstruct or whatever. And I think that's very clear that Socrates comes across as a very moral person, someone who's interested in the integrity of how we do philosophy. And some of his opponents come across as something rather the converse. In particular, Gorgias comes across as a little bit of a fool who will say anything to please. Polus, who believes that rhetoric is the way to power and that power is the greatest thing. Forget good or evil or whatever, power is the important thing and rhetoric is your way to power. He comes across as shameless in his defense of that. And of course, someone who thinks that rhetoric is the way to power and power is everything irrelevant of anything else would actually be shameless in that sort of sense. The final character in this is Callicles, who thinks that politics should be a matter of what is natural, and it is natural that the strong dominate the weak. Anything where the weak can get a grasp on the strong is unnatural and improper. And he comes across as rather a bully. And again, that's not overly surprising, because presumably his idea of politics is the person who does the best bullying is the greatest politician. And again, the question is going to be, in the case of Polus, is being shameless a way of doing philosophy? Or should you have some better sense of where philosophy is going and what it's trying to do? And presumably the answer to that is yes, you should. And again, with Callicles, is philosophy about bullying? Can you bully someone into agreeing with you? And if so, would that be a good thing? I suppose the other debate that comes out of Callicles is a debate about whether society should be natural or whether it should be ruled by laws. And I think Plato's position is very strong on this. If we're going to have a civilized society, this is something that should be ruled by intelligent laws rather than just what is natural. And of course, you can see that debate come through right to the present day. You will often find politicians sort of trying to claim this is natural. Or now then you find politicians arguing this is civilized as well. So that debate comes right to the present day.
Indeed it does. And in terms of character, so we've got Socrates, we've got Gorgias, we've got Paulus, we've got Callicles. And I think of the other three, I think of them as kind of a Gorgias as a kind of a barrister kind of character who will argue anything for money, who would take a certain position and argue it passionately and go for the win. And then I think of Paulus as the kind of smarmy politician who will do anything, say anything to persuade and to get themselves to the top. And Callicles I think of kind of as the dictator. dictator who is using the same kind of conversation to rationalize or justify a position. That's really crude characterization, but is that even close to being useful?
I think that that helps. And I think that helps in the sense that if we look around the political landscape of the world today, we can see characters like Gorgias, like Polas, like Callicles, and how they work. And I think one of the lasting lessons of Gorgias as a book is to understand how rhetoric and sophistry can be used. And that it can be used by powerful people and it can be used by intelligent people. When I saw Trump's first speech after he'd lost the election, right, I found that a fascinating use of rhetoric. Right? Now, you may disagree with this, but I think Trump's an incredibly good rhetorician. Right? And I think if we underestimate that, then we dangerously underestimate the power of Trump. He is very good at saying certain things in certain ways that appeal to a certain audience. And do we think that's good, intelligent, whatever? Our answer to that may be no, but is it good rhetoric? Oh, yes, it's very good rhetoric. And the way he puts those arguments together in for a certain conclusion is very well done.
So in a way, it's sort of effective because it works. And whether it's sort of good according to Plato's notion of the good, that's a totally different story. But that in essence is the argument that's happening inside of this book, isn't it? It's that effective rhetoric is one thing, and honest, truthful, truth-seeking exploration is quite another. And I suppose would it be true to say Plato is sort of criticizing a kind of runaway rhetoric where what's winning now is that effective sophistry, and what's losing is the search for truth. Is that sort of where he's at?
I think that's very much the case, and I think that comes from two things in Plato. One, from his philosophical commitment to the idea that there is such a thing as knowledge and there is such a thing as the good. And I think it also comes from his political experience in Athens, which had undergone various political convulsions, dictatorships and tyrants. And I think he sees Gorgias and the other sophists and the other people interested in rhetoric as facilitating those dictators and tyrants. And I think he sees there's a need to undermine that. And I think ultimately he also needs to make a ground for philosophy, to demarcate philosophy off from rhetoric and sophistry, and say, no, this is the ground of philosophy. This is what we're interested in, and this is how we do philosophy. And that's different from these things. And that's actually typical of ancient Greece at the time. So, for instance, if you look at what the early Hippocratic medical people were doing, they're doing the same sort of thing. In modern sociological terms, it's border work. They're trying to define what medicine is against all the quasi-healing disciplines, the soothsayers, the faith healers, the herbalists. They're saying, no, we are the medical people, and this is our ground. And Plato's also fighting that sort of same border work definitional ground about philosophy, saying, no, this is philosophy and it is useful. Because I think one of the things that comes across from the other three characters is they're all quite disdainful towards Socrates and the idea of philosophy. They're saying, this will get you power, this will get you money, this will get you what you want. Whereas Socrates is saying, that's all very well, but that's not actually going to do you any good. You actually have to examine your life. You actually have to examine what is good and what is proper. And that is the job of philosophy. And this is how we do philosophy. And philosophy needs to be demarcated away from this notion of sophistry and that notion of rhetoric.
I'm going to interrupt here. Let's take a short break. Let's get back to my conversation with Professor Andy Gregory. We're talking about this year's STS1 book, Plato's Gorgias. Let's hear what else Andy has to say. So, Andy, do you have a favorite part of this book, or does some part of the book stand out for you?
I think I have two parts of this book which stand out for me. So what I do in terms of research is I'm interested in the history of cosmology in the ancient world, how people have thought about our universe, the basic principles on which they put these things together. So I'm interested in that both in terms of philosophy, in terms of some philosophical questions about what constitutes a universe and how we think about that, and historically how that's been thought about. Plato wants to say something very important about what we would understand as our universe, and his term for that would be a cosmos. Now, the word cosmos in ancient Greece has some important connotations of a place that is well-ordered, a place that is also aesthetically beautiful and morally well-ordered. So it has extra connotations beyond our idea of universe. We might think our universe is sort of physically well-ordered, but the ancient idea of a cosmos which is morally well-ordered and aesthetically well-ordered, that's something I think we've lost to a certain extent. And one of the things that Plato wants to say in the passage in the Gorgias is that, look at the universe. We think it's a cosmos. It's well-ordered. It's got harmony. It's got proportion. It's got beauty. And don't you think that's true? And if you assume the converse of that, then our universe is going to be a random mess. But it isn't. It's a cosmos, and we can see it's a cosmos. We can see it works in a proper way, and we can see it has beauty. We can see it has order to it, and we can see it obeys laws in a proper manner. Now, I think that's a very important point to make, because that's critical in an ancient context. In a modern context, we might take the idea of laws underpinning the universe as something just given and straightforward. But I think one of the interesting things about STS, about history of science as well, is taking assumption like there are laws underpinning our universe and saying, where does that idea come from? Where was it actually justified? How did people argue for it in the first instance? And if we go all the way back to the Gorgias, we can say Plato saying, right, this world about us, it isn't a mess, it's a cosmos. It's well-ordered, and there are principles underpinning that. And there is a tradition which comes off of Plato, which says, okay, there's a mathematical order to the universe, and that mathematical order to the universe is harmonious and it's beautiful. Now, that's a particular position within the philosophy of science. You will find important people in the history of science very much agreeing with that. Einstein, for instance, thought that the laws of nature were beautiful, harmonious, and mathematical. And when you get those right, you see those right. Other people would say, no, this is being too aesthetic about it, and there aren't enough criteria to justify those things. Okay, so that's a debate in philosophy of science. But if you go all the way back to Plato, he will say quite straightforwardly, it's beautiful, it's orderly, it's mathematical, it's proportionate, and all those sorts of things about the cosmos. And I think that's very important in establishing a whole tradition about cosmology, one that comes through to the present day.
Right. And does Plato connect thinking about the cosmos with thinking about human behavior? So I'm thinking in the sense of if you look at the universe and you see order, truth, beauty, law, and then you start asking how do humans behave with each other, it seems like he's seeing the same thing. So we should be seeking truth and seeking the good and seeking those eternals. Is that a connection for Plato?
Very much so. So Plato would see human beings as a cosmos within themselves. Human beings have been generated by Plato's God, and he thinks they've been generated with, again, beauty, proportion, and in particular, a spark of intelligence, which they ought to cultivate. So he thinks that all humans are well-ordered. Any disease is a breach of that order, so the job of a medical person is to restore that order. I think politically, Plato thinks that a city-state should be aiming to be a cosmos, that is, a well-ordered thing. And again, he will talk about beauty, proportion, and all the rest of it in the ordering of the state, as well as the ordering of the human being and the ordering of the cosmos as well. So it's a very strong sense in which that runs through all of Plato's philosophy, not just the cosmology and the science, but the politics and the biology as well.
So Andy, what's your second favorite bit of the book?
My second favorite part of this book is when Socrates does a speech outlining a position which seems a little strange, and Polus laughs at him. And Socrates' reply to this is effectively, what are you laughing at? Is laughter a proper reaction in a philosophical discussion? And I think that's meant to reverberate not just within that drama, but it's meant to ask you a question as well. If you think that what Socrates just said is funny, is that a proper reaction? And is that a proper philosophical reaction in a discussion? Polus then says, Socrates, what you just said was so ridiculous, it refutes itself. Now, is that a proper move in a philosophical discussion? What Socrates then says is, OK, we're now going to take this seriously, and I'm going to give you the proper refutation of this view. Now, I think that's very interesting from a methodological point of view. Again, it's interesting drama within the dialogue, but I think it's meant to resonate out with the readers as well. Is that the way we do philosophy? If you laugh at something, is it refuted? If you put forward something that people think that's ridiculous, should you just drop it at that? And I think one of the important things about there is an anti-rhetoric thing, in that the rhetoricians are putting forward things that look plausible and pleasing and all the rest of it. If Socrates is putting forward something that looks strange, should that immediately be rejected, or should we look for the philosophical power that's beneath it? And I think that's an important methodological thing. That's one of my favourite parts of the Gorgias, when you do that questioning about how do we conduct a philosophical discussion? Because this is something that's open at the time. And Plato's making important points about this is what philosophy is, this is how we conduct it, this is where we're going with philosophy.
Right, okay. I've got two more questions about the book itself, and then we can go on and talk about kind of the longer-term influence of this work. First of all, this dialogue. To me, when I'm reading it, I think, you know, this should be a play. And I mean, I know that there's a lot of performance in Greek culture of this period. Was this meant to be performed, or is it something else? Is it a play?
I don't think it's a play in the sense that, to be bluntly historical, no one ever performed Plato's works as a play. It does raise a question about how philosophical works were perceived in the ancient world, and I think there has been a tendency by modern philosophers to treat them too much as textbooks to be read rather than things to be heard. So I think people would say about Shakespeare that you should read Shakespeare out loud so you get the cadence of the words out of it. Plato's Greek is often very beautiful, so I think, again, it's something to be read out loud. And it's, I mean, having done these sorts of things in reading groups where you just read them in English, it's actually quite good to read them in English and just hear the sort of back and forth of the conversations. That's not to say that there weren't philosophical works in the ancient world which were meant to be performed. There were ancient Greek philosophers who wrote in poetry, and quite strict poetry in the sense that the lines all not only rhyme, but they also scan, and there's particular schemes of getting the lines to scan. And it's clear that those things were not there to be read, they were there to be heard. And if you go back all the way to the foundations of Western literature in Homer and Hesiod, those initially were oral traditions, and they were written poetically so that people could remember them. The scanning is there to make sure you get it right. So again, Homer is something to be heard, and that goes through some of the philosophical tradition. I think that's probably been lost by the time of Plato, but there's still a relation to it. I still think you're meant to think of this as a relation between characters and a discussion and a dialogue, rather than something that's just a dead text. And I think Plato's very keen on pushing that.
Right, and back to that idea of dialogue in this context is more an argumentative style or technique rather than the idea that it's going to be performed. It does kind of, I can't help what when I'm reading it thinking, okay, now exit stage left, you know, kind of character. But anyway, that's just me. The last question about the book itself is, I mean, the simplest way to frame it is to just say, does it have a winner? But does it have a grand conclusion? Does it have a takeaway message?
I think the takeaway message of this would be that sophistry and rhetoric are not things that are good in themselves. They may be useful tools, but for things to be good in themselves, you need to do philosophy, and you need to think about philosophy very hard. And I suppose the other message, which I think is a little more hidden in the way that the characters interact, is that there's got to be a proper method for doing philosophy. And that can't be bullying. It can't be sophistry and rhetoric. It's got to be a proper discussion of people who take things seriously. And I think that's something that's relevant to philosophy today. And the discussions we'll have in SDS as well, that you've got to engage in these things properly, you've got to be respectful of what other people say, and think about very hard about the nature of the discussion. I think the issue of definition that the Gorgias starts out with is very important, both as a general philosophical thing and for us in SDS, because what Plato does is say, okay, give me a definition of rhetoric. And it's clear that Gorgias's definition of rhetoric is not adequate. Now, the interesting thing here is that actually it's quite plausible when you first see it. But when you think about it harder, you start realizing, oh, there's that assumption in it, or that doesn't work, or this doesn't work. And that's very important for the work we do in STS, because a lot of the time we're going to look at definitions of what science is, or some particular aspect of science, or whatever. And you're going to say, okay, this is the face value definition we're given. Is it good enough? Or is there something behind that that we can take apart and look at more carefully and then think, yes, this is actually rather more important. So I think that's something to take away from the Gorgias as well. When we look at things in philosophy, when we look at things in science, when we look at things in technology, what's important there? Can we take this apart a little bit? Is there a more sophisticated understanding of it? The final thing I think is a takeaway thing from this is that there's a difference between having a knack to do something and having a proper knowledge of things. That's really important for Plato, because he's going to go on about, okay, a cook may have a knack of producing something that you like, but a cook is not a doctor. A cook has not understood, striven to understand what the nature of the human body is, what is good for the human body, what is bad for the human body. The doctor could be said to have a knowledge, the cook merely has a knack. Now that's important for us in science and technology studies, because clearly we study technology, and technology might be said to be something where we have a knack for doing things. But is technology in and of itself good? And does it produce the good? And I think those would be questions that we'll ask throughout the course, particularly in relation to contentious bits of technology, such as nuclear weapons or biological weapons or other bits of technology. Are they things that are in and of themselves good? We'll also ask the question of, actually, what's the difference between technology and science? Because technology, we seem to have the ability to do something, need really understand where it fits into things. With science, surely we have something more. We have a higher level knowledge of things that have been organized and set out, and we can relate it to other things. And I think that will be an important question. But the Platonic question that will come about out of all of this will be, is technology a moral endeavor? And is science a moral endeavor? And how do we go about doing technology and science so that they perhaps are better moral endeavours? So I think that's an important takeaway thing from the Gorgias, which will be important for us in science and technology studies.
I mean, we've talked about a couple of long-term influences that this book has, for example, for us today. But are there other long-term influences that you want to flag up?
Okay, let me answer that in terms of a slightly different question, which is the global context of it. So some might say, look, this is a book by a dead European man, a long dead white European man. Clearly it has relevance within a Western European philosophical context. does it have relevance outside that sort of narrative? And I think, yes, it does, because it asks some fundamental questions, both for philosophy more generally and for science and technology studies. So one of the things that Plato wants to say is something like this. Look, in order for us to be able to know anything, surely there is such a thing as knowledge. And that knowledge is transcendent. It exists somewhere else, if you like, and we latch onto it. So we all have opinions, but we actually reckon there's something that is knowledge beyond that. And one of the things Plato wanted to attack is the idea that there are only equal opinions and there's something beyond that. There's a sort of relativism that's sometimes talked about today. And I think that issue of that notion of Platonic knowledge is still a relevant one. And of course, Plato is the first person to come up with ideas of self-reference, which talk to that. So Plato will say, if you say nothing is true, he will then say, is it true that nothing is true? Right. So that sort of thing dates all the way back to Plato. It's still relevant to those sorts of issues about knowledge today. For us in science and technology studies, there's a question about science. Is science something which is culturally bound? Is it something that's a product of Western culture, which has then been imposed on the rest of the world? Or has science actually latched onto something absolute, and is it producing, to, in a certain sense, some absolute knowledge? Now, that's a very live debate. Sociologists might tend towards the more relative issue of this and saying science is entirely a cultural artifact. Philosophers of science might push more towards saying there's some sort of absolute sense in which science is right. But I think there's a large debate to be had there. And I think there are ways in which we recognise, yes, there are cultural influences and cultural boundaries to Western science. But the question I think Plato would raise for us is, is there some knowledge that's being generated by that in an absolute sense as well? Is it something that's beyond knowledge? I think the other question that Plato would raise, as something that goes beyond the European narrative, is there a good? Is there something that's transcendently good? And that's something we've come to be suspicious of, I think, in recent years, perhaps with, to a certain extent, the demise of religion pushing the idea of an absolute God, which is a good that's come from a Christian God. If we're going to follow that line and say, no, there isn't a good coming from God, is there a good that we can understand outside of that? And I think that is a question that Plato would raise, and I think that's important outside its Western context as well. I think that's a general question for philosophy outside of a Western context as well.
This book is about 2,400 years old. That's a long time. And if it was started off on wax and it became a paper scroll, I mean, how does it survive 2,400 years? That's a long time. So how does it make it?
Plato had great fame in antiquity. His academy lasted for many hundreds of years. So his works would have been copied in antiquity for people to read and used as didactic works within the academy, and people would have worked on it, and they just kept copying them. So the first copies we have are from around the 12th century AD, right? So those are the copies we work from. Prior to that, they would have been copied and copied and copied from the originals. Now, there are transcription errors, and there's a sort of tree of these manuscripts. And people who work on these things, there's a sort of industry of trying to produce definitive texts of Plato, because there are accumulated errors which go through these little trees of copying. But the texts we work from nowadays are from about the 12th century, 13th century. And we have reasonably definitive texts of Plato. There are little bits which are fiercely fought over by scholars. But generally, we think we've got pretty much Plato's entire corpus in a reasonable form. And that's just pure copying of copies. Some of this would have gone through an Arabic tradition, in that initially these works would have been in Greek. Some of them were preserved in Greek through the Latin West. Some of them have been preserved either in Greek or Arabic through the Arabic tradition, and they become important again at the time of the Renaissance. But the scholarly copies we work from, they're usually 11th, 12th, 13th century. People gather together half a dozen of them, go through them line by line, comma by comma, and try to produce a definitive text.
Do you get a sense of this book's popularity being different in different parts of the world, or is there another way to kind of look at that?
Well, I mean, there are 40 of Plato's works. It's difficult to rate them, in a sense. There are the most famous works of Plato. The most famous work is his work, The Republic, and that's probably the one that's most commented on. The next most commented on in antiquity is a work called The Timaeus, which is on natural philosophy. One of the ways of trying to track how important or interesting it was is the number of commentaries that are done about on it in the ancient world. So you will have people in the Western tradition will take the text of it and will write commentary on it and notes on it, and you'll find a similar thing in the Arabic tradition as well. And from that we understand, yes, people read these things, and yes, they were influenced by them. Is it Plato's most influential work? Probably not. Probably The Republic is, and it's his most famous work. But The Gorgias is still an important work by Plato.
Andy, I think we've brought our discussion of the Gorgias to a quick conclusion. We're just getting started with this conversation. We're going to talk about it all through the year as the SDS One Book program continues. But I'd like to thank you for taking the time to get us started, and I look forward to talking about the book more with you later on in the year. Thanks very much.
Splendid. Thank you, Jack.
Well, I have to admit, I'm converted. At first, I thought this was an odd selection for the SDS One Book program this year, but now I'm convinced. It's a very clever choice just as we launch our new master's degree in science communication. Thanks to Professor Andy Gregory for helping us out with Plato's work. He's given me some material to pass along, and I've put that information in the show notes. If you're looking for a copy of the Gorgias, there are plenty around. Check in the secondhand shops. Check online libraries like the Internet Archives and Project Gutenberg. Also, check the resources available through UCL libraries. If you're more comfortable reading in a language other than English, look for Plato's book there too. French, German, Mandarin, Farsi, Arabic. It'll be great to compare how the Gorgias comes alive across different translations and across the emphases of different translators. Music today included two pieces. Rollin' at Five by Kevin MacLeod. That's available online at the site filmmusic.io. I also included Busted Flat Blues, which I got from Apple's GarageBand. We Are SDS is a production of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. If you want to find out more about the show, listen to past episodes, or give us some feedback, just visit us online. Here's the address, so write this down. It's ucl.ac.uk/sts/podcast. That's it for today. Thanks for coming along. We'll have another episode ready soon, including episodes from this year's STS Newsroom. Until next time, everybody, just remember, there's knowledge to be found just about everywhere. And together, we are STS. Bye now.
You've been listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Subscribe to the show and join us online. The address, ucl.ac.uk/sts/podcast.